Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, COVID-19 cases continue to increase in number. Two deaths are reported in Cabarrus County. Mecklenburg and Cabarrus counties issue stay-at-home orders. Governor Cooper orders more businesses to close while the federal government, the state, and city look for economic relief for businesses and for workers. Meanwhile, schools go online, cancel proms and midterms, and CMS unveils a $1.6 billion budget. And number one is 86th. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and joining us in that effort from the comfort of her own home, the worldwide headquarters of Ann Doss Helms. She is here, our education reporter. Hello, Ann.
Greetings from Gaston County.
You're welcome. Well, oh, you're in Gaston County, are you? It looks just like Charlotte in your camera. WFAE's David Borax is also with us. Good morning, David.
Hello from beautiful downtown Davidson.
Gosh, we're everywhere today. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Jonathan?
Center City District.
Okay. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Where are you, Eric?
Greetings from Beverly Woods in South Park.
Okay. Give us your exact street address, why don't you? All right, thank you.
Send
all for
complaints
being
to Mike Collins.
Let's start here where we are in terms of the number of coronavirus cases and just how fast that number is rising. Last Friday morning on this program, we reported 43 cases in Mecklenburg County. This morning, there are 204. I believe that's accurate. Last Friday morning, the state was reporting 136 cases. Today, that number stands at 716. As of yesterday, Union County reported 27 cases, Gaston 7, Iredell 13, Cabarrus 21, York had 18. And some of the increase in Mecklenburg is due to younger people being infected, which led County Manager Dina DiOrio to issue a stay-at-home order, which went into effect yesterday morning at 8 a.m.
We know that 80% of the cases in the county are those below the age of 59, which is an indication that older residents are heeding the warning to stay at home while younger residents are not. Voluntary compliance of existing orders, both at the state and local levels, are not what we would like to see.
So the state has already experienced two deaths, both in Cabarrus County. One was a resident, I believe, in their late 70s. The other was a patient from Harnett County in their late 30s. Both had underlying medical conditions. A third person actually died in North Carolina, but he was someone from Virginia traveling through the state. Those deaths prompted Governor Cooper to say that they were a stark reminder that we must take this disease seriously. Are there indications that that is happening now, Jonathan?
We'll have to see. As the mayor put it in her news conference this week, that's the point of this 3-week stay-at-home order that we're seeing now in Cabarrus, Gaston. It's going to be at 5 o'clock this evening, and now Mecklenburg County. But I want to go back to the messaging that we, and remind people of the messaging that we started with on this coronavirus before it, you know, became what it is today in the U.S. And that was, we were told that this would affect mostly people with compromised immune systems and people over the age of 65. So you couple that with the politics that have been involved with this. It's just, I think people have really, you know, that age group really didn't pay attention to the warnings. So we'll have to see with these stay-at-home orders if they are now listening. And I don't know, you know, the data has been really, you know, we're getting numbers, but we're not really, the data has been lagging because, you know, we're catching up to where Wuhan, China, and Italy have already been. So we'll have to see.
I know this is anecdotal, but every one of us has personal lives and we all go to the grocery store, even if we're on this stay-at-home thing. As you go out and do the things that you have to do, and this war order went into effect at 8 o'clock yesterday morning, so up until 8 o'clock yesterday, everybody was doing anything. Are you noticing people distancing themselves from each other? David?
Go ahead, David.
I was just going to say that it's kind of a mixed bag here, because we are seeing, like, the business districts in the downtowns are empty. At rush hour yesterday afternoon in Davidson, there were no cars on the street. However, if you walk around, I did find like two groups of people sitting behind the coffee shop having coffee, even though that's banned right now. So it's not fully compliant right now. And I want to channel my colleague, Claire Donnelly, our health reporter at WFAE. We were talking about this in our meeting the other day, and she said, you know, people are not getting the point here. They're just not getting this. And, you know, she says people should stop trying to find loopholes, and you're going to have to change what you do. I think that's the message that's not getting through.
A good example to follow up with what David's just said, you know, Crowder's Mountain Park, I don't know if you know, but they had to shut it down because it just got so overcrowded. You know, they're trying to encourage people to get out to exercise, but you still have to maintain that social distancing. And that's what they were telling people before we got to the stay at home order. And I think that's why we got to this point, because though, like David mentioned, the business districts are dead. You go by Romare Bearden Park, you go by Freedom Park, you still see people gathered, laying out. You know, we've had a couple of days of nice weather earlier this week. You still see people in those areas, like in parks, still gathering as if nothing's going on. At least from what I've seen, and I've been out this week.
I think you still have a lot of people who just don't. They still are very skeptical that this can happen to them. And it is a disconnect between what you're seeing, obviously, on the news and hearing on the radio. I mean, when you see, for example, the triage conditions at these hospitals in New York and Washington State and some of these other places, you would think that would start to really curb some behavior. I think it has, but I think David and Jonathan are right. You see plenty of examples of people who continue to just kind of blithely go about their business. And I don't know what else we can say about how serious this is, but we're going to spend the next 40 minutes trying to do it.
And this has got to be an even bigger challenge for parents with young children, because they're going to be stir crazy. You're going to want to take them out maybe to a park or something. You don't want to terrify the kids, but kids tend to just run over and congregate. So, you know, I was at a teacher parade where the parents were trying very hard to keep their kids spread out, but it's just really hard to get children to respect a 6-foot social distancing.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, I've seen video of other cities where people in grocery store workers are putting tape squares on the floor at the checkout lines, separating each square by 6 feet so people will know where to stand. And they're putting up these plexiglass shields between you and the cashier in the non-self-service checkout. Is that happening here?
Yes, it is. CVS, I know had to go pick up a prescription. They have put tables in front of the registers and at the pharmacy, separating people. It's clear that you're 6 feet away from the cashier. Also noticed yesterday, I went to Petco, pick up some dog food. They have blue lines along the register area, separating people. So I definitely have seen examples of retailers out there trying to maintain that social distance.
David.
And just one point, we journalists are exempt from the stay-at-home orders, although as you can see this morning, all of us are working out of our homes and we're trying to do that. But last week before this went into effect, we were out and about, and there was a press conference on Monday the 16th at Government Center announcing this COVID-19 response fund. And they had tape on chairs to keep everybody 6 feet apart. And I'd like to say most of us did that. It was kind of hard. We were all still just getting used to that idea, but it's now a reality and we need to do it.
I even know that, Mike, that grocery stores are now asking people, because you have to think now you're going to need to sanitize. There's a whole process that the CDC has in sanitizing groceries and things you bring home from the store. But I know that certain stores are no longer allowing people to bring in those reusable bags. You know, a lot of us are trying to recycle and be a lot more greener these days. But, you know, in order for the store to protect their employees and other customers, they're now preferring that people just use the plastic bags and then throw those away when they get home.
So in South Carolina, there have been at least 9 deaths reported, including news yesterday that lobbyist Jack West, who's the son of the late Governor John C. West, has died. Do we understand why there are more deaths in South Carolina? Are there more cases in South Carolina?
There are not more cases. Last I saw, South Carolina was in the 500 range. And we're, what did you say, Mike? Are we 700 plus now?
716.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. Now, they have not been as strict with limitations as you just mentioned. The thing that strikes me most about that is remember, and maybe a lot of people on this show probably know it, North Carolina's population is twice that of South Carolina. So obviously they're getting hit very, very hard.
I think the mortality rate, Mike, might be higher in South. They have fewer, you know, they don't have anywhere near the amount of cases that we have, but they have more deaths. We have a lot of cases, but very few deaths.
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out. But in South Carolina, the governor there, Henry McMaster, also pointed the finger to people not taking this seriously, as we've already talked about, and not abiding by voluntary stay-at-home suggestions.
That lack of discipline, that lack of consideration, lack of forethought, and lack of consciousness about what is going on is what will result in the spread of this virus.
So because of that, Governor McMaster has banned gatherings of more than three people, but he has not issued any stay-at-home orders. Have counties in South Carolina done anything like that? Are they doing this on their own, or are they also not doing it? Do we know? We don't know. Okay, that's fine. In an article, Eric, that you wrote in the Charlotte Business Journal earlier this week, you reported that in Mecklenburg County, females account for 53% of the cases, males 47%. And interestingly enough, nationally, males seem to be more impacted by this. Ethnically, it breaks down this way, you say, 40% white, 37% black, 7% Hispanic, and 4% Asian. Do you know if those numbers have changed since you wrote that?
We have not gotten an update. I'm pretty sure that was from Gibby Harris's remarks to the county commissioners the day of the stay-at-home order. She said that day that they will be updating twice a week now with those demographic numbers, the geographic numbers. She mentioned that same day that there were, I think, five different zip codes that had 7+ cases in Mecklenburg County. So they're getting much more specific with the data than they have been. The other thing is when you're going through those demographic rates, she said they were aligning pretty closely with what the demographics are in Mecklenburg County.
And just one observation about these demographics is we were told, it is true, early on we were warned that, you know, elderly people and people with underlying health conditions would be most affected by this. What we weren't being told and what we didn't internalize is that everybody can get this. And, you know, you may not be as affected if you're 35 years old or 25 years old. It may not hit you quite as hard. But in fact, those people become carriers of the disease. And I think the problem that we've been having so far and the reason why we have these clamping down on people gathering and that sort of thing is because people are out and about and the disease is spreading.
It's just, I think it's difficult for people to understand this because this, as the president has said continually, is invisible. You can't see it. And we have never been through anything this magnitude in this country in anybody's living memory. So people just can't get it in
their brains around it.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of which, there's been a lot of talk nationally about the slowness of the federal response or the erraticism of the federal response to all of this, especially in New York City, where they are the epicenter of the world now, it seems to me, in these cases. And several New York City hospitals have been described as apocalyptic because of the number of cases, and they simply can't handle it. This morning, The Observer is reporting that county hospitals are planning for a possible bed shortage here. Atrium CEO Gene Woods says they have hours, not days, to flatten the curve. And he goes on to say that if 20% of those infected become hospitalized, we would need twice as many beds as we have. And so far, statewide, 21% of those infected have required hospitalization. When we come back, I want to talk about this because we keep being told that our hospitals can handle it. They say they can handle it. I'm not sure they can. We're coming right back. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here, one of our reporters from WFAE News, with Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter from Spectrum News. Eric Spanberg is managing director of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Ann Doss Helms is an education reporter, among other things, here at WFAE. And we're talking, of course, right now about coronavirus and its impact on our area. I mentioned a second ago that hospitals in New York are being overwhelmed by this. Our county hospitals are planning for a possible bed shortage. They say that if 20% of those infected have become hospitalized, they will need twice as many beds as we have. Around the state, 21% who have gotten this disease are hospitalized. And Dr. Sid Fletcher, who is the Novant chief medical officer, says the size of the anticipated surge is unknown because we haven't had enough testing. And State Health Director Mandy Cohen says the state will start using surveillance techniques as they do with the flu rather than relying on tests. And they're now asking people with mild symptoms to stay home and skip the tests to help limit the spread and to save supplies for those more seriously ill. I asked Dina DiIorio about this earlier this week, and I think I asked Mayor Lyles about this. Are our hospitals prepared? And they seem to say, or seem to believe, that the answer to that question is yes. Are we being naive?
There was an interesting survey that was done by the Associated Press, and it was picked up by WUNC, our sister station up in Raleigh. Jason DeBruin wrote an article saying that hospitals across the state really don't have a lot of excess capacity right now to handle what will be an onslaught of cases. And at this time of year, hospital beds statewide are already at 80 to 90% capacity. So we are facing, if this gets worse, which it inevitably will, we're facing a situation where there will not be enough beds.
Meanwhile, go ahead, Jonathan, go ahead.
So I was just going to add 2 points. Earlier this week, the mayor did that 40-some minute long teleconference. And she did say, though, that, she kept bringing up the stimulus package and saying that, and this is a direct quote, she said, "I think that we all know that we don't have every tool that we'd like. We don't have every piece of equipment that we would desire, but we are trying very hard to work at every level to get that material in." So it does sound, at least in that part of her news conference, that she's hearing from Atrium and Novant. But Mike, there's one other point we should this is going to impact a lot of people. And even if you don't have coronavirus, Atrium, Novant, and Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, there's a group that said that they are rescheduling all non-essential surgeries, procedures, and ambulatory appointments effective Wednesday, March 18th. That is so that they can focus on what they believe is going to be an increasing number of COVID-19 cases.
Our Steve Harrison from WFAE reported this week that Charlotte tourism officials have discussed with Mecklenburg emergency officials using the Charlotte Convention Center and Bojangles Coliseum as places to care for patients with the virus. County emergency management officials asked the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority last week if they had available space. But there really hasn't been an ask, evidently, from Atrium and Novant for this. And in a letter to county officials sent this week, it was the CEOs of Atrium and Novant who asked for the stay-at-home order. Why aren't they asking for these spaces to be prepped? The convention center can't be used, I'm told, because it's under construction. But why haven't they asked about Bojangles Coliseum?
Very interesting as you go through these numbers, Mike, and we're going through the scenarios. And what was said previously is absolutely right. At the media briefings and the virtual teleconferences, the county manager and the mayor have both said that they have been told they, at the moment, do not need to find more space. So I'm not sure. It does feel like a contradictory sentiment, but maybe things are changing so fast that overrode what they were saying at the moment. I'm not sure.
We were talking a minute ago about demographics here, and David, this is affecting younger people in greater numbers than we thought it would. Do we know what those numbers are among younger people in the state?
Just early on, when they're giving out numbers for Mecklenburg County, the demographics showed that half the cases in the county were people in the 20 to 39 age group.
And this lack of testing has been a problem around the country. Now they're telling you if you have minimal symptoms, don't get the test, just stay home. But they've opened, Atrium Health opened a testing location at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Eric, we keep getting conflicting messages from everybody about
this. There's also a testing center in Salisbury, too.
Okay.
Well, and for example, with the Speedway, when I was speaking with both the health company and the Speedway, they kept emphasizing that, yes, we have this testing center, but you can only be tested if your doctor orders you to be tested. So it's to expedite the people who are approved. But you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, as we're talking about all these things, the logistics, the hospitals, everything going on, we in the media obviously are very focused on the numbers as they're updated every day by both the state and the county health departments. But what this conversation is showing is that we really don't know. I mean, we don't have enough testing. You're being told not to ask for a test if you have mild symptoms. So who knows what the actual rate really is in terms of how many people have COVID.
Oh, and people aren't social distancing like they should.
Right,
and it does pose an interesting question. If you have a few days of feeling cruddy, you've had a cough, you don't get tested, do you know if you've had it? Are you now immune and you can go out about your business? And I think this is especially important for healthcare workers, but they are being tested. But for your average person, you may not know whether you've had it or whether you just had some other crud.
So we have an email from a guy named Mike, not from me. I work at a golf course, he says, in Charlotte, and we have been busier than ever since people are allowed to work from home. They're treating it like vacation time. The course has had 150 plus rounds a day from sunup to sundown. You can go to the golf course under the stay-at-home order. Is that wise?
Well, that's interesting because that question came other day in the stay-at-home order, right? And Gibby Harris said, yes, you can go play golf, but you have to have social distancing. The example she gave, the counter example was, don't go play basketball because, you know, you'd be running into each other, sharing a sweaty ball, sweaty basketball and all this stuff. And so it is baffling that you can go do things like play golf when everyone is supposed to stay home.
All right. Mecklenburg County stay-at-home order is in effect until midnight, April 15th, for all but people working in essential services and limiting travel to necessary trips to grocery stores and pharmacies and healthcare providers. Not following these orders could result in being charged with a misdemeanor. But yesterday, 1 hour into the order going into effect, Mayor Vi Lyles was on this program, and I asked her just how effective this will be if CMPD follows through on their plans to be lenient in their enforcement.
I am hopeful, and I do believe that our community, the people that live here that have been at home now for several weeks, all of that going on, they will embrace this idea because it's the only way that we're going to be able to flatten the curve.
So we're only one day, 25 hours into this. Does it appear that people are complying? Did anything change yesterday from the day before, anecdotally?
I know there was a rush on barbershops and salons in particular. We reached out to them because, you know, that's one of the things that people just, you know, one of those things out there that we, you know, never second guess being able to go get a haircut or going, you know, to get your hair fixed. And so I know on Wednesday there was a rush, at least in Mecklenburg County, it was a rush on barbershops and salons. And there was concern among those barbershops, Mike, like a lot of small businesses right now, how they're going to make it through without being able to get access to their clients.
We're going to talk about that in a second. More than 3 million Americans lost their jobs. That is an astounding number of people between March 14th and March 21st, and even during the Great Recession, job losses rarely exceeded $500,000 in a single week. What kind of numbers are coming out of Mecklenburg County or North Carolina or some of our surrounding counties? I know that this morning it was announced that Discovery Place laid off all of their part-time or 75% of their part-time and full-time workers, and this is happening everywhere. So do we have any numbers locally?
We have some statewide numbers. There have been over 200,000 unemployment claims between Monday the 16th and yesterday afternoon. About 185,000 of those are related to COVID-19 as far as we can see. there have been a lot of really small layoffs and some really big ones that we've noted. I was looking at the North Carolina WARN notices yesterday, and there are a lot of companies that have done temporary layoffs, and they have 7-8 employees. Yeah. There's some big ones in Mecklenburg County, like the Charlotte Airport has laid off over 800 people from all of those service jobs there. So it's kind of all different kinds of situations. I think North Carolina doesn't have the highest unemployment benefits. It's only a couple of months worth, a couple hundred dollars. But we're going to see that system strain.
Yeah, because between March 16th and 26th, Mecklenburg County had 200,000 new unemployment claims. That's a year's worth of job losses in a week and a half. And that is why Congress has been working on these relief bills and why the state has made getting unemployment easier and quicker, and why Mayor Lyles has said that local funding will supplement the $2 trillion stimulus package passed Wednesday night in the U.S. Senate.
We're outlining options that we think we can do. So can there be a no-interest loan fund? Could there be some ways that we could help with rent as people are having to close up? So, you think about your stylist, whatever, hair, nail, whatever, and they've got a lease and they have to pay rent, but they are having to shut down their businesses. Is there some way for us to help with those kinds of issues and problems that they have?
In her press conference on Wednesday, she mentioned everything is on the table, including a reduction of property taxes being considered. But on this program yesterday, it was clear that anything the city might do is still very much in the early, early talking stages. There are so many unknowns in this situation. How long can people wait for government to act, to step in here?
Well, an awful lot of people are just a paycheck away from trouble.
Right.
So, and bear in mind, too, that the ripple effects from this can be, if you lose your job, you're eventually going to lose your health insurance. So this is hugely complicated. There are some grocery stores that are saying, well, we're hiring. But then, of course, if you take that job, you are potentially putting yourself at more risk for exposure.
Mike, and also, to add to Ann's point, Spectrum News and some of our reporters were following apartment complexes this week that were reaching out, sending people emails, telling them that, we understand this is a difficult time right now. They've since backed off from this, but telling people in an email that, we understand it's a difficult time, but your lease still requires you to pay your rent. And they've since backed off of that. But, you just have to wonder what is really truly being done to people that have lost their jobs, and are they being really cared for and receiving compassion from the community.
I mean, even if these $1,200 checks come out from the federal government, that really is nothing.
Because people are already behind.
And it won't even pay your rent. I mean, I'm not sure what they're thinking here with $1,200, and not everybody's going to get those checks.
It's going to be interesting to see what sort of organizing there will be for those of us who are still employed, who get the checks. Will there be opportunities to donate for those who need a lot more than they're getting? Mm-hmm. Because right. I think a lot of us may feel like I don't need a bonus. As long as I've got health insurance and a job, I want to help someone else.
One sector where people do work paycheck to paycheck and where they don't have a lot of support in terms of benefits is in the salon industry. And we talked earlier this week to Emily Warner, who earns a living as a stylist at Bohemian Style House in Plaza Midwood. And she shared with us some of the things that they are doing as alternatives to a regular paycheck.
We have seen huge amounts of clients specifically talking to each stylist and sending us prepaid appointment cash and just money just to help us along, which is amazing. We're so grateful for them. We do have personal relationships with everyone, so we're texting, emailing, doing whatever we can to reach out to them, and they're doing their best to, help us out during this crazy time.
Some monetary policy experts are suggesting that the federal government simply call for a moratorium on paying bills. They point out that the banks right now are getting loans at zero or near zero interest rates from the Fed. It's not costing them anything to extend credit to other people at the moment. So they get what they need, while ordinary people should simply be told, these experts say, that they don't have to pay their mortgage, their rent, their Visa bill, their phone bill, make their car payment for a month or two or more with no penalties, no fees, no interest accruing. And I want to stress, this has not happen, but it's just being suggested. But anybody in a position to make that happen, are they considering this?
I mean, I think the most that we've heard are things such as, you know, the utility companies saying that they would not cut people off, the cell phone companies saying they would not cut people off during this. I have not heard yet of people doing what you're saying. That's an interesting proposition. And Mike, it goes back to a lot of the things that frustrated people during the Great Recession and the way that the companies were treated or corporate America was treated versus everyday Americans.
Because with this stimulus package that just was approved, the airlines are getting about $80 billion, I believe, of assistance. And you know that.
What strings are attached to that? I never heard what the outcome of that was, because people were very – Democrats were concerned that they would use this to compensate the CEOs and buy back stock, and they wanted to make sure that would not happen. Is that – prohibited in this legislation?
I believe those things were prohibited. There are still critics who are saying that as the airlines were making hefty profits in recent years,
exactly,
they were doing that. They were
right.
giving
now,
those
let's
raises.
Not forget,
they were buying back stock.
And I fly, so full disclosure there, but let's not forget that people have been complaining for the last 5, 6, 7 years about all, you know, since 9/11, about all the fees that airlines have instituted and right. how many billions they make. And so now we have a situation where, you know, after the Great Recession, it was the auto industry. This case, it sounds like it's going to be, you know, Boeing is getting a lot in this stimulus package. And I read an interesting article raising the question of, you know, is that fair considering what has happened with the 737 MAX and their relationship with the FAA. So there's a lot, you know, COVID-19 and the testing and the treatment that's needed juxtaposed to, you know, this bailout and the stimulus package and who's getting all of that money.
I'm not sure stimulus is the right word for this. I think this is a survival package for the nation,
yeah.
individuals and corporations. There are some rules attached to this $1,200 check that some people will be getting, David. Is that right?
Yeah, we actually, there's put out the following information about this. If you make less than $75,000, or if you're a married couple making less than $150,000, you'll get that $1,200 per adult and $500 per child under the age of 17. But if you make more than that, they eventually will phase out. And if your individual income is more than $99,000 or your family income $198,000, you will not get this. So, and to your point earlier, if you're in a group that doesn't really need this, you know, certain people will not get it.
David Borax from WFAE News. We have to stop. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks. Ann Doss Helms is here, our education reporter from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg, chuckling in the background, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter for Spectrum News. And David Borax, a reporter here for WFAE. Of course, the governor announced the closings of salons and spas and theaters and other things this week, and limited restaurants to take out only. And when he announced those things, those latest closings, he said that we will be issuing additional orders soon. Do we have any idea what he was talking about?
We could only assume, obviously, these would be tighter restrictions, but I'm not sure what those would be. Maybe more enforcement of where people go as some of these counties come in with these stay-at-home guidelines, but that's just a guess.
There have been good things that have come out of this, I suppose. The generosity of people. We're all in this together. We keep hearing that. We keep being told that. And, David, you've been looking into this because there's been an outpouring of financial support into the COVID-19 response fund. I'm not sure people know what that is, how much has gone in, what is it, who's administering it?
That's right. There have been more than $10 million in donations made by companies and individuals across Mecklenburg County. It was started by the Foundation for the Carolinas and the United Way of Central Carolinas. The idea here is that social service agencies are being overwhelmed with new requests for help. We know that with the stay-at-home order, a lot of people will not be able to go to work, and there'll be people who are in need of emergency aid that way. The agencies themselves are doing more. And so they have said they're going to be announcing soon where some of the first grants are going. But the donations are coming in, like I said, from small and large, including some of the biggest companies around here, the foundations. It was actually started by a donation from LendingTree and CEO Doug Lebda, who approached the Foundation for the Carolinas about this idea. In fact, he said he had never heard of the Foundation for the Carolinas before that happened. So there really is an outpouring. There's also a fund that CMS is raising through its foundation to help out. So they're popping up everywhere. The community social service agency up here in North Mecklenburg as well is doing its own small fund.
So let's talk about
I think you're seeing a lot of it play out on social media and just small individual acts. Somebody, one of the younger members of our church posted, I'm going to go grocery shopping. If you are in one of those risk groups and you want me to get your groceries, let me know. And they're kind of trying to organize a shopping network so those of us who may be a little older than the rest can limit our exposure.
So as Governor Cooper was making this announcement about closing additional businesses, he also helped CMS decide about whether to resume classes. The governor made that decision for them by closing all schools until at least May 15th.
Now, I know that many parents have been expecting something like this. Many of you have become homeschool teachers in the past week, and I know that this is extremely difficult for you and your children. But this is what we need to do to help to slow the spread of the virus.
So as I understand it, online schooling begins Monday. Is that right, Ann?
Well, I think it has begun informally. There have been these supplementary lessons. And as with so many things, there are real equity issues here. There are going to be homes where the parents are making sure the kids learn, where they've got all the resources. You may have kids for whom this is the first real challenge in life. And so it's a real learning experience for them. And then you have families who are on the brink. You have high school kids who may be looking after younger siblings while they're supposed to be learning from home. You have inequities among counties. At one of the state meetings online yesterday, you had somebody who represents four coastal counties who said, we can't do online learning. We don't have that kind of internet access. And a deputy superintendent said, absolutely, that access is one of the biggest challenges we have in doing this.
And you told our Gwendolyn Glenn on All Things Considered this week that there's more of a plan to make a plan with regard to how all this will impact the rest of the school year. And you said that North Carolina Board of Education Vice Chair Alan Duncan has said there are hundreds of decisions to make as we redefine this school year and beyond. What are some of those decisions?
Well, like one of the ones they were talking about at the time was the end of grade and end of course testing, these big standardized exams. It seems pretty obvious to everybody, and we have gotten a federal waiver now, that, okay, yeah, let's not take those exams. You can't proctor them. You know, we may or may not be able to do them in person. Okay, get rid of the exams. And a big discussion yesterday among this House panel was, okay, so you get rid of the exams. Now, what we have state laws that say you have to use those results for school letter grades, for low-performing school lists, for teacher bonuses, principal bonuses, teacher evaluations. There's even the Read to Achieve law that says promotion to fourth grade depends partly on your third grade reading exam results. So they're sitting there looking at, and I've sort of thought, well, where is the General Assembly in all this? And it turns out where they are is they are at this point are not coming back into full session early, but they are doing a lot of work in these online meetings too.
But have they not eliminated midterms? I know they've eliminated the proms, but have they eliminated midterm exams for these kids?
Yes, but midterms are not the same as these high stakes end of year tests.
And we are hearing that state public schools could start the next school year in early August. Where does that stand? Is that just being talked about?
Right now, everything's still just kind of out there floating. The Board of Ed is discussing what can we do by ourselves? What do we need legislators to approve? And calendar flexibility would require legislative approval. So those ideas were tossed out in this panel meeting. And then you had Craig Horn from Union County jumped in pretty quickly and said, don't everybody get upset because you've heard this. That does not mean it's going to happen. It means it's something we're looking at. But calendar flexibility has been, you know, in play. A lot of schools would love to have flexibility because even if you don't have coronavirus, you have hurricanes, you have all sorts of situations. So we're going to see, A, if it will happen temporarily, and B, if it might become a longer-term thing.
Jonathan.
One of the things I heard, I just wanted to put a button on what Ann just said, is I think one of the things I heard in that news conference is that all options are on the table. So when you say all options are on the table, it means, you know, it could go any number of ways, and they haven't really settled on anything.
Well, one of the things that we're noticing around the country, I haven't noticed it yet, but maybe I haven't been using the internet except to type and download things off of websites. But people are at home, working from home. Students are at home, working from home. You've got a lot of online learning and Zoom meetings and GoToMeeting things going on. You've got people streaming television probably more often than they normally would because they're home all day and they're bored and they can't get out of the house. What's happening with this? Because you have that, and you have home Wi-Fi systems, David, that are strained by all this extra computer work going on at the same time. Are we facing a critical infrastructure failure here?
Well, I looked into this this week because I'm seeing a little bit of a slowdown myself here at home. In fact, I figured out that on my network, which is usually quiet during the day, there are now 10 devices on it at one time. So that's a problem here locally. But with some of these internet sites and people seeing internet speeds go down, it's actually happening. I talked to Doug Suttles, who's the CEO of Ookla. That's a company that does speedtest.net. You may have heard of that. Mm-hmm. Downdetector.com. So they're in touch with what's going on. And he said that it's actually very localized. For example, there are wide areas where there is no problem with the internet. Business districts right now where everybody has cleared out, no problem with the internet there right now. But in areas where people are working at home in large numbers, they're down. And he looked into some numbers for North Carolina for us. In particular, Mecklenburg and Guilford counties have seen internet speeds go down by about 10% in the last couple of weeks. Not so much in Wake County. I'm not sure if that's because they have better internet infrastructure there because of government and universities. But in any case, we are seeing it go down in some places. For example, Westchester County in New York, where they're having a big issue with the coronavirus outbreak, 25% decline in internet speeds there. So, you know, it's something we're all going to have to live with for a while. His opinion is that there are some areas where internet providers were just not prepared for this.
Yeah. Something else is happening. In an abundance of necessary caution, Mayor Lyles held a press conference this week remotely. No one was in the room. The state is doing some things similar to that with their coronavirus updates. No reporters in the room. They're being piped in through the phone. County Commission met in what appeared to be a conference room this week that allowed them to be more spread out than they would normally be in their normal meeting room, and that meeting was streamed. And last week, CMS held a digital press conference on the shutdown of schools, but no press was invited to be there, so some weren't even notified that they were holding this press conference. And Ann, this week, CMS school board presented their $1.6 billion budget, and you pointed out that these, yes, are trying times. Everyone's trying to be safe, find new ways to do things, but this is an example, an unfortunate example of that. Why?
Well, I think the digital press conference in particular, it was a misnomer, but I think whether it is press conferences or whether it is public meetings, they're having to find new ways to do them. The budget was a very sparse presentation. I mean, I was panicking as I was trying to report it because I had so little information to work from. They were just
plus there were, as I understand it, there were no reporters there for this presentation. Is that right?
No, they said no audience. So okay. We could stream it like anybody else, but we could not reach anybody for questions. All the things I normally would have done, like run over and grab CFO Sheila Shirley, who is great with these things. Couldn't do it. We were looking at a handful of PowerPoint slides, and they were having trouble getting the full budget report even posted online.
Yeah, you reported that they have a $37 million request for additional money from the county, which we'll talk about in a second. But that request was outlined in a 12-page PowerPoint presentation with only four slides. And when you quote pried, end quote, the budget document out of the board, it turns out to be a 117-page executive summary. Normally, it would be 300-plus pages. You called that unprecedented in its lack of detail. How do you explain that?
Well, I finally did reach Sheila Shirley, and she was able to explain some of that. And she said they actually went to this executive summary format last year under Clayton Wilcox, and they're moving forward with it. there's a lot of detail. And again, not many people are reading 300 pages of budget documents, but for those who want it, it used to be there before they had public hearings, before they took votes. Now it's apparently going to be made public after the school board votes. There are always these public forums. They had meetings scheduled to go out into the community and talk about the budget, obviously canceled because of the coronavirus. So I want to be clear, this is not, you know, something that they've cooked up to hide from the public. But there, you have to think about, there is so much interest in public policy decisions, whether it's how you handle school closings or it's how the county is going to deal with an unprecedented surge of need, even as they're likely to be going into a recession that shrinks their income. How do we incorporate the public in a meaningful way where questions are asked and comments are heard?
So they're asking for $37 million more from the county in this $1.6 billion budget. I want two questions very quickly. What for? What's the $37 million for? And are they likely to get it, given that the county is likely now to face incredible shortfalls of revenue?
Well, I think the second question is easier. I think they are not likely to get it. And after talking to Sheila Shirley, I think this is almost like that thing where you recognize your exit as you're speeding past it and you have to kind of say, okay, we're going to go to the next one and double back. They were so far down this budget process when the COVID-19 crisis hit hard that they realized that this may not be realistic, but there wasn't time to prepare a new budget. So I think, and Superintendent Ernest Winston kind of touched on this again in a way that was hard to figure out exactly what he was saying, but he was saying there's always some revisions as we go through this, but there may be some pretty major revisions as we hear from the county.
Jonathan.
And Mike, this same situation that Ann is describing with the school board budget, let's remember that the county and the city council, they're also working on their next budget. So it will be interesting to see how this all plays out, because Ann is absolutely right. There are documents that are posted before meetings that we have a chance to go through, reach out, ask questions. And then when they have those forms that Ann mentioned, that's not just, people don't just need to think of that in the realm of the school board. This especially is impact City of Charlotte and the Mecklenburg County Commission.
Especially since the mayor made those comments that everything's on the table and they may look at tax rates. They may look at a number of policy and budget decisions as this impact is felt.
So politics is kind of gone by the wayside, but there is a big convention scheduled for Charlotte in August, the Republican National Convention. Mayor Lyles hasn't said much about the fate of this, but Republicans say they are moving forward. Donald Trump was on Sean Hannity last night addressing the Republican convention, and he said there's no way that he's canceling the Republican convention in Charlotte.
Somebody was asking today, will you cancel the convention? I said, no way I'm going to cancel the convention. We're not going to cancel. It's going to be incredible. We're at the end of August, and I think we're going to be in great shape long before there.
Okay. If we're not in great shape, is it his call, or will it be public health officials' call?
Well, I think it will be public health, at least here in the county, because he did say further in that interview that it will be up to the governors of those states whether, you know, things are reopened in April. But I do know that, you know, people within the president's party here locally in the state are moving forward with that process.
Yeah, Marshall Lee Kelly, the Republican Convention's president and CEO, has said that party officials are taking additional steps to ensure the safety and health of all attendees. Not sure what those steps are, and we don't have time to go into them now anyway, but state conventions are finding alternative ways to be held. Is that right? Very quickly, Jonathan. Is that right?
Yes, they are meeting via virtual video conference like we're doing right now, but they are still moving forward with electing and seating delegates.
So Panthers number one has been 86. The team released Cam Newton this week. He's a free agent. On his Instagram account, he said he was hungrier now because he's unemployed. As CBS Sports listed four logical places that Cam could end up: the Las Vegas Raiders, the Los Angeles Chargers, the Buffalo Bills, or, wait for it, the New England Patriots. Anybody put some bets on it, put some money on that?
Did you say Jacksonville?
No, I did not say Jacksonville.
Jacksonville on that list.
And by the way, Teddy Bridgewater sounds like an R&B singer, not a quarterback. I just want to say that.
Wow.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for ending on a laugh, Mike. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, Ann Doss Helms and David Borax from WFAE, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Stay well. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.